From NPR and WBUR Boston, this is special coverage of President Obama's final news conference of the year. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. President Obama will take questions this hour from the press in the White House briefing room. We're expecting him any minute now.
He's about to head out on a 17-day vacation to Hawaii. But first, we expect reporters will press him on the NSA report, another health care rule scale back, lingering questions about Syria, nuclear talks with Iran. There is so much. We have a troop of NPR correspondents standing by to help us take it all in. National security correspondent Larry Abramson is waiting in the wings, as is health policy correspondent Julie Rovner. But let's start with NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, what do you think will be first out of the gate when the questions come?
Well, I suspect that topically the NSA report that was just made public this week will be high on reporters' minds. We know that the president is going to take that report with him on his Hawaiian vacation, not exactly beach reading, and come back next month with his own conclusions about what should be done with the intelligence architecture here in this country. And I think that'll be among the first questions. But as you say, there's lots to talk about. This new ruling that gives folks who lost their original health insurance policies a waiver from the individual mandate, and also the opportunity to buy catastrophic care, something that the insurance industry is not happy with, another chink in the individual mandate. So lots of things for the press to inquire about.
Yeah, Larry Abramson, let's talk about that NSA story, because this is something that everyone's been talking about. What might he be asked about?
Well, you know, the biggest question, I think, is the first recommendation that the panel made, and that is that the NSA should shut down the bulk collection program, where it collects nearly records of every phone call in the United States. This is a program that the president has defended as being essential to the fight against terrorism. He said that it's legal, and now his own panel has said, no, it's not. This is really a bad idea. You need to get rid of it. So there's a question of how the president can ignore that recommendation or any of the other 46 recommendations, many of which go against what the president's own heads of the NSA have said is important to them.
But we're not likely to hear today whether, in fact, he is going to accept these recommendations, right? He's going to take that with him to Hawaii and figure it out later.
Right. As Scott said, the president has said that he's going to review this. There are actually several reviews of intelligence, going on right now. There's also the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board is preparing a report that will be out soon. There are internal reviews going on, and the president wants to take in all of that information before he makes any decisions.
That's NPR's national security correspondent Larry Abramson. You also have Scott Horsley, NPR's White House correspondent, and health policy correspondent Julie Rovner here with Jeremy Hobson and Robin Young. We're waiting for President Obama to step out to have his last press conference of 2013. And Julie, I'm sure the questions will also be, as we've said, about what he is calling Obamacare. Overnight, there was a new ruling that people who lost their plans because their plans didn't comply with the new requirements will be allowed to either go without insurance for an entire year or buy a whittled down form of insurance without paying the penalty. This is upsetting others.
That's right. It's particularly upsetting the insurance industry, which says it didn't know anything about it. That basically this came at the behest of several senators, mostly Democratic senators, some of whom are facing pretty tough reelection bids next year. They were worried about people who had gotten these cancellations and hadn't been able to find what they deemed affordable replacement insurance. So basically the administration has said, with just a couple of days before the deadline, okay, you can go out and buy this catastrophic insurance instead. Now, previously this catastrophic insurance had been limited to people under the age of 30 and people who could prove financial hardships. That was expected to be fairly small numbers of people. Well, now this could be potentially a couple of million people. The administration says there's really only a couple of 100,000 people left whose insurance had gotten canceled who haven't found alternative coverage now. But the way it's written, it looks like those people who found alternative coverage could, you know, go ahead and switch and buy this cheaper insurance. And the insurance industry did not price this catastrophic insurance, assuming that lots and lots of people would buy it. So they're not very happy about it.
And Julie, how do you think the president will handle what will surely be overall questions about health care reform? We're based here in Massachusetts, where there are a lot of bumps in the rollout of the insurance plan here that the national one is modeled on. And, you know, there were a lot of shifts and delays and the goalposts were moved quite a bit. But for the president to say that at this point, you know, people may not want to hear that. So how do you think he will approach questions about the overall problems?
Well, you know, he's been pretty consistent. He said, you know, that the rollout obviously has not gone well. It has not gone as well as they had hoped. It's, in fact, gone even worse than they had. They'd predicted some bumps, but this has obviously been a lot bumpier than they'd intended. He's tried to stress that the law is a lot more than just the website or really just the pieces of this individual market, people who buy their own insurance. But obviously, you know, he wants things to go better, and he wants to broaden this out, point out that we're only halfway through this open enrollment period. The website is working better, although I should point out it was down for a couple of hours even today.
Oh boy.
So he's going to have a lot to answer for. Yeah.
Scott Horsley, let me go back to you. This news conference is coming at a time when the president's approval rating is at the lowest it's ever been, according to a lot of polls. There's a CNN poll out right now that has him at 41%. Is this something he wants to do to try to push that number up, to come out and answer all the questions that are causing that number to sink?
Well, I don't think he's going to say anything today that's going to cause those numbers to turn around. But look, the president's going to be very happy to say goodbye to 2013. This has been a bad year all around for the president. I mean, he's had tough breaks on domestic policy, tough breaks on foreign policy. That's not to say there haven't been, you know, a few glimmers of positive news for the president. He sort of stumbled into a deal that may rid Syria of its chemical weapons. There was at least a temporary breakthrough in talks with Iran, which is something that's been high on the administration's foreign policy agenda really from the beginning, and it may turn out to be a payoff for a very long build up in sanctions. But beyond that, I mean, when you look around what this president set out to do this year in terms of stricter gun control in the wake of the Sandy Hook shootings, immigration policy, where he thought the Republicans would have a political incentive to cooperate with a comprehensive reform, maybe some progress on the budget. He wanted to forestall the sequester. That wound up kicking in. There's not a lot of good news for the president to point to. So he'll come out, he'll take his lumps today, he'll go off and, you know, come back in January and hope to maybe have a fresh start in 2014.
You know, you mentioned the budget, and this is this rare bipartisan deal that's been reached on Capitol Hill. But we should note that there is still an outstanding issue of the debt ceiling, which is going to be hit again in February. That has not been dealt with. Do you expect the president to take a tough tone with Congress, or do you expect him to be more conciliatory?
Yes, I think he'll take a very tough tone. That worked for him in October, and I don't see any sign that they're going to change. In fact, Jay Carney's been asked at a number of White House briefings this week if the president would give any ground on that. And his position, ever since 2011, when he suffered a real setback and all sides took their lumps and the nation wound up with its credit rating downgraded, his position ever since then has been to say, look, I'm not going to negotiate on the debt ceiling. This is the full faith and credit of the United States is not something to be used as a bargaining chip. It's up to Congress to fix it. And he held that line going into October, and ultimately the Republicans caved. I think he'll certainly at least start out with that same negotiating position here.
Yeah, that's NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley. We've also got our national security correspondent Larry Abramson and health policy correspondent Julie Ravner waiting with Jeremy Hobson and me, Robin Young, for President Obama, who is scheduled to give his last press conference of 2013 before he heads off for a break.
As if it's a big shock that he's late for this one. I think every time the president has had a news conference, it's
been a hallmark of his time, you know, being prompt. But I'm sure there's some I's to dot and T's to cross. And Scott, I'm wondering, is there anything where we've talked about a lot, but it's sort of a parlor game, I suppose. But might there be a surprise topic that we're not thinking about?
Well, not necessarily a surprise. I think one thing the president might talk about today is the announcement that he formalized just this morning. It had been rumored for a few days here in Washington that Montana Senator Max Baucus will be his choice to be the new ambassador to China. That's interesting for a number of reasons. One is Baucus has been the chairman of the powerful Finance Committee, and he spent really the better part of the last year working with Dave Camp on the House Ways and Means Committee to try to deal with tax reform. If he is now dispatched to Beijing, prospects for tax reform, which weren't great to begin with, I think are sort of torpedoed more. But the political subtext of all this is that it could affect the balance of power in the Senate. Now, Baucus, who's a Democrat from a fairly conservative Western state, had already announced that he was going to retire at the end of next year. And the Republicans were salivating over the chance to fill that seat with a Republican. If they could do that, that would be one of six they need to take control of the upper chamber in Congress. Now, if Baucus is sent over to China early in 2014, Montana's Democratic governor would have the opportunity to pick his replacement. He would presumably pick John Walsh, the lieutenant governor, who could then run to fill the seat for a permanent seat in 2014 with all the advantages that come with being a sitting U.S. senator. So that's a potential that the Democrats would very much like to see give them a better chance of holding on to the control of the Senate, which has been looking a little tenuous.
Larry Abramson, let me go back to you for a second. This news conference is, of course, going to be heard and seen here in the United States, but it's also going to be watched around the world. And this comes just a day after Vladimir Putin gave his big end-of-year news conference. I'm sure that there are going to be people that are part of the Rouhani administration in Iran that are watching this to see what the president says. Talk about that, the president speaking to the rest of the world in this conference.
Well, you know, and as we were talking about the intelligence recommendations, this is something that the rest of the world is watching very closely. The U.S. has alienated a lot of its allies through these revelations, through Snowden leaks, Edward Snowden leaks, that we are spying on some of our closest allies, including Germany. And, you know, they want to see radical reform in the intelligence community. The president has resisted that idea, saying that, you know, there are some changes that we can make, but we really can't stop gathering important information about people that we work with. And now he's facing more and more pressure to do exactly that, to take some radical reform. So I think that's one thing people overseas will be watching very closely.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, Jeremy, speaking of you raise Putin's press conference yesterday, which went 4 hours, by the way, so we're hoping that that doesn't happen here. But Scott Horsley, what about the relationship with Russia? What might the president be asked? We have both, the president not attending or even sending any high-level administration members because of the gay rights issue, we understand. But has he ever said that?
Yeah, I remember a news conference last August, which was just after the White House had announced that the president would not be making a stop in Moscow on his way to the G20 summit in St. Petersburg. And there were, I think one of the early questions at that news conference was all about the U.S.-Russian relationship.
And that was because of Snowden, right? That was because of Edward Snowden.
Well, and you might remember the president famously described his positive working relationship with Vladimir Putin. He says, don't read too much into that body language of him where he looks like the bored schoolboy in the back of the class. And, of course, everybody, all anybody remembers is that the president said Vladimir Putin looked like a bored schoolboy at the back of the class, not that they had a positive business-like working relationship. But, you know, there was also at that point in August, the president addressed the issue of what to do about Russia's then new anti-gay rights legislation, and in particular calls for maybe an Olympic boycott. And he said, I don't believe in Olympic boycott. I hope we send some great athletes over to Moscow, over to Sochi, and maybe some out gay and lesbian athletes bring home medals. Well, this week, of course, we had the announcement of the delegation from the U.S., including several openly gay athletes, and as you say, no high-ranking U.S. officials in an obvious snub to the Russians.
Well, but if he's asked that, I mean, do you think he will say we are not going because?
Yes, he might not put it exactly that bluntly, but he's been pretty clear that he is an outspoken critic of the Russia's track record when it comes to gay rights, and I think you know his spokespeople have said this week, it's not as if he waited to name the Olympic delegation to make that point. He's made that point himself publicly in the past, but I don't think there's any question that was in mind when the makeup of the Olympic delegation was formed.
Mm-hmm. It's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. If you're just joining us, we are waiting for President Obama's final news conference of the year. It was supposed to start at 2 o'clock Eastern time. We're now about 2:14 Eastern, and we're still waiting for the president to appear at the podium there in the White House briefing room. We're joined here by NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner, NPR national security correspondent Larry Abramson. I'm here. I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young. And Julie, let me go back to you. Many observers have said that the health care law is going to be the biggest part of President Obama's legacy, at least at this point. Does he see it that way?
Oh, I think he certainly does. And he knows that this is important. He knows that certainly the rollout of the law this fall has not gone well. He wants to get it straightened out. And certainly the Republicans who have opposed it from day one have been salivating at everything that's gone wrong and jumped on it at every opportunity. And I think he really feels very strongly that this is something he really needs to get straightened out and has worked very hard to get things going on the right track, you know, lest his entire legacy be bogged down in, you know, in things that are not going right. So I think it's very, very important to the administration that this thing be set on a better path than it is right now.
Well, he's sure to be asked about that today when the press conference begins. And as we said, he's sure to be asked about the NSA report that came out. Larry Abramson, back to you on that. The president has already said, or the White House has already said, that he will not accept or is not in favor of the recommendation that the leadership of the NSA be split off from the Pentagon. Right now it's one person running both. But what might he accept? Is there anything he might say today that he's prepared to accept? Let's say a civilian advocate on the super secret FISA court.
Exactly. That was the example I was going to be bring up. A lot of people seem to think that this is a good idea, and you could argue it's kind of a harmless idea in that there's not a lot of damage that could be done by having perhaps a civil liberties advocate appear before this court rather than just having the government make arguments for surveillance. So I think that that's something that's very likely to be adopted. It's not that easy to implement that particular idea because this person would have to be have a high-level security clearance. It's not clear which rulings they would actually participate in. But that's one idea that I think could go over. The other is that the panel made several recommendations about improving security so that these leaks don't happen in the first place. Let's remember that the NSA is supposed to be the geniuses at computer security, and a low-level contractor was able to rip off all this information. And the panel said, you know, they really need to have better tracking software in order to be able to detect that. And I'm sure the president will say, yeah.
Scott Horsley, we've gotten the warning there to the press corps in the briefing room that it should be just about another minute before President Obama comes out. But I want to say this is he goes to Hawaii every year, but he almost always gets stuck here for at least a couple of days because of some last minute deadline in Washington that he has to stick around for, whether it be the debt ceiling or whatever. This is the first time he's been able to take off.
I can remember that he's actually taken off on the day that they initially announced that he would leave.
Well, the day isn't over yet.
<That's right. laughs> You never know what might happen.
Don't even say it, Robin. I think that's right. He is getting off more or less on time, and that is news that the budget deal, small though it is, didn't come down to the 11th hour this time.
Yeah. It's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. We've also been speaking with NPR national security correspondent Larry Abramson and NPR health policy correspondent Julie Robner. They're all in Washington, and we are waiting for President Obama to appear at the podium in the White House briefing room. It should happen any minute now, Robin.
Yeah, and we're perilously close to talking about what our holiday plans are here. But as we wait, anybody want to jump in with what I'm interested in is
that when we talk about the health care being, you know, the cornerstone of the president's legacy, one reason for that, of course, is that there was a tremendous political backlash to both the health care law and the sour economy in 2010, which cost the Democrats their majority in the House. And since then, really no other piece of the president's agenda has been able to get through politically. So this was a big deal, to paraphrase the vice president, but it's also sort of the last thing, or just about the last thing, the president was able to get done before the GOP took over the House. And since then, we've sort of been in gridlock.
Well, I have to say, Scott, over the course of the day, you made a joke about whether the president, you know, in the long list of things he might be asked about, whether he would be asked about the comments of the stars of the reality show Duck Dynasty.
Yeah.
And he just might because...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because they made negative comments about gay people. And this has been another cause the president has taken up.
Oh, you know, whether it's Trayvon Martin or the name of the Washington football team.
You hear those cameras clicking, Scott. It is time to go to the press.
I know you are all eager to skip town and spend some time with your families. Not surprisingly, I am too. But you know what they say? It's the most wonderful press conference of the year right now. I am eager to take your questions. But first, I just want to say a few words about our economy. In 2013, our businesses created another 2 million jobs. adding up to more than $8 million in just over the past 45 months. This morning, we learned that over the summer, our economy grew at its strongest pace in nearly 2 years. The unemployment rate has steadily fallen to its lowest point in 5 years. Our tax code is fairer, and our fiscal situation is firmer, with deficits that are now less than half of what they were when I took office. For the first time in nearly two decades, we now produce more oil here at home than we buy from the rest of the world. And our all-of-the-above strategy for new American energy means lower energy costs. The Affordable Care Act has helped keep health care costs growing at their slowest rate in 50 years. Combined, that means bigger paychecks for middle-class families and bigger savings for businesses looking to invest and hire here in America. And for all the challenges we've had and all the challenges that we've been working on diligently in dealing with both the ACA and the website these past couple months, more than 500,000 Americans have enrolled through healthcare.gov in the first 3 weeks of December alone. In California, for example, a state operating its own marketplace, more than 15,000 Americans are enrolling every single day. And in the federal website, tens of thousands are enrolling every single day. Since October 1st, more than 1 million Americans have selected new health insurance plans through the federal and state marketplaces. So all told, millions of Americans, despite the problems with the website, are now poised to be covered by quality, affordable health insurance come New Year's Day. Now, this holiday season, there are mothers and fathers and entrepreneurs and workers who have something new to celebrate, the security of knowing that when the unexpected or misfortune strikes, hardship no longer has to. And you add that all up, and what it means is we head into next year with an economy that's stronger than it was when we started the year. More Americans are finding work and experiencing the pride of a paycheck. Our businesses are positioned for new growth and new jobs, and I firmly believe that 2014 can be a breakthrough year for America. But, as I outlined in detail earlier this month, we all know there's a lot more that we're going to have to do to restore opportunity and broad-based growth for every American, and that's going to require some action. It's a good start that earlier this week, for the first time in years, both parties in both houses of Congress came together to pass a budget that unwinds some of the damaging sequester cuts that created headwinds for our economy. It clears the path for businesses and for investments that we need to strengthen our middle class, like education and scientific research. And it means that the American people won't be exposed to the threat of another reckless shutdown every few months. So that's a good thing. It's probably too early to declare an outbreak of bipartisanship, but it's also fair to say that we're not condemned to endless gridlock. There are areas where we can work together. I believe that work should begin with something that Republicans in Congress should have done before leaving town this week, and that's restoring the temporary insurance that helps folks make ends meet when they are looking for a job. Because Congress didn't act, more than 1 million of their constituents will lose a vital economic lifeline at Christmas time, leaving a lot of job seekers without any source of income at all. I think we're a better country than that. We don't abandon each other when times are tough. Keep in mind, unemployment insurance only goes to folks who are actively looking for work. A mom who needs help feeding her kids when she sends out her resumes, or a dad who needs help paying the rent while working part-time and still earning the skills he needs for that new job. So when Congress comes back to work, their first order of business should be making this right. I know a bipartisan group is working on a 3-month extension of this insurance. They should pass it, and I'll sign it right away. Let me repeat. I think 2014 needs to be a year of action. We've got work to do to create more good jobs, to help more Americans earn the skills and education they need to do those jobs, and to make sure that those jobs offer the wages and benefits that let families build a little bit of financial security. We still have the task of finishing the fix on our broken immigration system. We've got to build on the progress we've painstakingly made over these last 5 years with respect to our economy and offer the middle class and all those who are looking to join the middle class a better opportunity. And that's going to be where I focus all of my efforts in the year ahead. And let me conclude by saying, just as we're strengthening our position here at home, we're also standing up for our interests around the world. This year, we've demonstrated that with clear-eyed, principled diplomacy, we can pursue new paths to a world that's more secure, a future where Iran does not build a nuclear weapon, a future where Syria's chemical weapons stockpiles are destroyed. By the end of next year, the war in Afghanistan will be over, just as we've ended our war in Iraq, and we'll continue to bring our troops home. And as always, we will remain vigilant to protect our homeland and our personnel overseas from terrorist attacks. Of course, a lot of our men and women in uniform are still overseas, and a lot of them are still spending their Christmas far away from their family and their friends. In some cases, it's still in harm's way. So I want to close by saying to them and their families back home, we want to thank you. Your country stands united in supporting you and being grateful for your service and your sacrifice. We will keep you in our thoughts and in our prayers during this season of hope. So before I wish a Merry Christmas to all and to all a good night, I will take some questions. Jay prepared a list of who's naughty and nice, so we'll see who made it. Julie must be nice. Julie Pace of AP.
Thank you, Mr. President. Despite all of the data points that you cited in your opening statement, when you look back at this year, very little of the domestic agenda that you outlined in your inaugural address and your State of the Union has been achieved. Healthcare rollout obviously had huge problems, and your ratings from the public are near historic lows for you. When you take this all together, has this been the worst year of your presidency?
I got to tell you, Julie, that's not how I think about it. I have now been in office 5 years, close to 5 years. Was running for president for 2 years before that. And for those of you who've covered me during that time, we have had ups and we have had downs. I think this room has probably recorded at least 15 near-death experiences. And what I've been focused on each and every day is, are we moving the ball in helping the American people, families, have more opportunity, have a little more security, to feel as if they work hard, they can get ahead. And if I look at this past year, there are areas where there obviously have been some frustrations, where I wish Congress had moved more aggressively. You know, not passing background checks in the wake of Newtown is something that I continue to believe was a mistake. But then I also look at, because of the debate that occurred, all the work that's been done at state levels to increase gun safety and to make sure that we don't see tragedies like that happen again. There's a lot of focus on legislative activity at the congressional level. But even when Congress doesn't move on things they should move on, there are a whole bunch of things that we're still doing. So we don't always get attention for it, but the Connect Ed program that we announced, where we're going to be initiating wireless capacity in every classroom in America, will make a huge difference for kids all across this country and for teachers. A manufacturing hub that we set up in Youngstown, something that I talked about during the State of the Union, is going to create innovation and connect universities, manufacturers, job training to help create a renaissance, build on the renaissance that we're seeing in manufacturing. When it comes to energy, this year is going to be the first year in a very long time where we're producing more oil and natural gas here in this country than we're importing. That's a big deal. So I understand the point that you're getting at, Julie, which is that a lot of our legislative initiatives in Congress have not moved forward as rapidly as I'd like. I completely understand that, which means that I'm going to keep at it. And if you look at, for example, immigration reform, probably the biggest thing that I wanted to get done this year, we saw progress. It passed the Senate with a strong bipartisan vote. There are indications in the House that even though it did not get completed this year, that there is a commitment on the part of the Speaker to try to move forward legislation early next year. And the fact that it didn't hit the timeline that I'd prefer is obviously frustrating, but it's not something that I end up brooding a lot about.
But sir, it's not just your legislative agenda. When you look at polling and you talk to Americans, they seem to have lost confidence in you, trust in you. Your credibility has taken a hit. Obviously, the health care law was a big part of that. So do you understand that the public has changed in some way their view of you over this year?
But, Julie, I guess what I'm saying is if you're measuring this by polls, my polls have gone up and down a lot through the course of my career. I mean, if I was interested in polling, I wouldn't have run for president. I was polling at 70% when I was in the U.S. Senate. I took this job to deliver for the American people, and I knew and will continue to know that there are going to be ups and downs on it. You're right. The healthcare website problems were a source of great frustration. I think in the last press conference I adequately discussed my frustrations on those. On the other hand, since that time, I now have a couple million people, maybe more, who are going to have health care on January 1st. And that is a big deal. That's why I ran for this office. And as long as I've got an opportunity every single day to make sure that in ways large and small, I'm creating greater opportunity for people, more kids are able to go to school, get the education they need, more families are able to stabilize their finances. You know, the housing market is continuing to improve. People feel like their wages maybe are inching up a little bit. If those things are happening, I'll take it. And, you know, I've said before, I've run my last political race. So at this point, my goal every single day is just to make sure that I can look back and say, we're delivering something. Not everything, because this is a long haul. All right. Mark Felsenthal.
Thank you, Mr. President. One of the most significant events of this year was the revelation of the surveillance by the National Security Agency. As you review how to rein in the National Security Agency, a federal judge said that, for example, the government had failed to cite a single instance in which analysis of the NSA's bulk metadata actually stopped an imminent attack. Are you able to identify any specific examples when it did so? Are you convinced that the collection of that data is useful to national security as you continue as it is?
Let me talk more broadly, and then I'll talk specifically about the program you're referring to. As you know, the independent panel that I put together came back with a series of recommendations, 46 in total. I had an extensive meeting with them down in the Situation Room to review all the recommendations that they had made. I want to thank them publicly because I think they did an excellent job and took my charge very seriously, which is I told them I want you to look from top to bottom at what we're doing and evaluate whether or not the current structures that we have and the current programs that we have are properly addressing both our continuing need to keep ourselves secure and to prevent terrorist attacks or proliferation of weapons of mass destruction or other threats to the homeland, and are we also making sure that we're taking seriously rule of law and our concerns about privacy and civil liberties. So what we're doing now is evaluating all the recommendations that have been made. Over the next several weeks, I'm going to assess, based on conversations not just with the intelligence community, but others in government and outside of government, how we might apply and incorporate their recommendations. And I'm going to make a pretty definitive statement about all of this in January, where I'll be able to say Here are the recommendations that we think make sense. Here are ones that we think are promising but still need to be refined further. Here's how it relates to the work we're doing, not just internally, but also in partnership with other countries. And so I'm taking this very seriously because I think, as I've said before, this is a debate that needed to be had. One specific program, the 215 program, is the metadata, the bulk collection of phone numbers and exchanges that have taken place that has probably gotten the most attention, at least with respect to domestic audiences. And what I've said in the past continues to be the case, which is that the NSA, in executing this program, believed, based on experiences from 9/11, that it was important for us to be able to track if there was a phone number of a known terrorist outside of the United States calling into the United States, where that call might have gone. And that having that data in one place and retained for a certain period of time allowed them to be confident in pursuing various investigations of terrorist threats. And I think it's important to note that in all the reviews of this program that have been done, in fact, there have not been actual instances where it's been alleged that the NSA in some ways acted inappropriately in the use of this data. But what is also clear is from the public debate, people are concerned about the prospect, the possibility of abuse. And I think that's what the judge in the district court suggested. And although his opinion obviously differs from rulings on the FISA court, we're taking those into account. The question we're going to have to ask is, can we accomplish the same goals that this program is intended to accomplish in ways that give the public more confidence that, in fact, the NSA is doing what it's supposed to be doing? I have confidence in the fact that the NSA is not engaging in domestic surveillance or snooping around. But I also recognize that as technologies change and people can start running algorithms and programs that map out all the information that we're downloading on a daily basis into our telephones and our computers, that we may have to refine this further to give people more confidence. And I'm going to be working very hard on doing that. And we've got to provide more confidence to the international community. In some ways, what has been more challenging is the fact that we do have a lot of laws and checks and balances and safeguards and audits when it comes to making sure that the NSA and other intelligence agencies are not spying on Americans. We've had less legal constraint in terms of what we're doing internationally. But I think part of what's been interesting about this whole exercise is recognizing that in a virtual world, some of these boundaries don't matter anymore. And just because we can do something doesn't mean we necessarily should. And the values that we've got as Americans are ones that we have to be willing to apply beyond our borders, I think, perhaps more systematically than we've done in the past. Okay? Ed Henry.
Thank you, Mr. President. I want to follow up on that because Merry Christmas, by the way.
Merry Christmas, Ted.
When Edward Snowden first started leaking the information, you made a statement on June 7th in California, and you claimed to the American people that you had already reformed many of these surveillance programs. You said you came to office, quote, my team evaluated them, we scrubbed them thoroughly, we actually expanded some of the oversight. And you did expand some of it.
Yes.
You also said we may have to rebalance some, there may be changes. But you concluded with, quote, you can complain about Big Brother and how this is a potential program run amok. But when you actually look at the details, then I think we've struck the right balance. Mm-hmm. That was only 6 months ago. Yeah. Now this judge is saying no, your own panel is saying no, even you're saying no, we haven't really struck the right balance, perhaps. Yeah. That changes have to be made. My question is, were you wrong then because you were not fully read in, not just on these programs, but on other programs outside of the ones you just talked about, where we were potentially listening in on the German leaders, the Brazilian leaders, and others that suggest there were abuses, number one. And number two, If you were fully read on these programs, is it another example of what Julie was getting at with this question of credibility with the American people? That just like on healthcare, you like your plan, you can keep it. On surveillance, you looked the American people in the eye 6 months ago and said, we've got the right balance. And 6 months later, you're saying, maybe not.
Well, hold on a second, Ed. I think it's important to note that when it comes to the right balance on surveillance, these are a series of judgment calls that we're making every single day because we've got a whole bunch of folks whose job it is to make sure that the American people are protected. And that's a hard job because if something slips, then the question that's coming from you the next day at a press conference is, Mr. President, why didn't you catch that? Why did the intelligence people allow that to slip? Isn't there a way that we could have found out that, in fact, this terrorist attack took place?
Why did you say we struck the right balance?
So the point is, Ed, not that my assessment of the 215 program has changed in terms of technically how it works. What is absolutely clear to me is that given the public debate that's taken place and the disclosures that have taken place over the last several months, that this is only going to work if the American people have confidence and trust. Now, part of the challenge is that because of the manner in which these disclosures took place, in dribs and drabs, oftentimes shaded in a particular way, and because of some of the constraints that we've had in terms of declassifying information and getting it out there, that that trust in how many safeguards exist and how these programs are run has been diminished. So what's going to be important is to build that back up. And I take that into account in weighing how we structure these programs. So let me just be very specific on the 215 program. It is possible, for example, that some of the same information that the intelligence community feels is required to keep people safe can be obtained by having the private phone companies keep these records longer and to create some mechanism where they can be accessed in an effective fashion. That might cost more. There might need to be different checks on how those requests are made. There may be technological solutions that have to be found to do that. And the question that we're asking ourselves now is, does that make sense not only because of the fact that there are concerns about potential abuse down the road with the metadata that's being kept by a government rather than private companies, but also does it make sense to do because people right now are concerned that maybe their phone calls are being listened to, even if they're not? And we've got to factor that in. So my point is that the environment has changed in ways that I think require us to take that into account. But the analysis that I've been doing throughout has always been, you know, periodically looking at what we're doing and asking ourselves, are we doing this in the right way? Are we making sure that we're keeping the American people safe, number one? Are we also being true to our civil liberties and our privacy and our values?
I understand it's a tough job, right? And God forbid there's another terror attack, every one of us is going to be second-guessing you, and that is extremely difficult to be in the Oval Office.
That's okay.
But as you said, you took that on. You put it on your back. And so my question is, do you have any personal regrets? You're not addressing the fact, the public statements you've made to reassure the public. Your director of national intelligence, James Clapper, months ago went up, got a question from a Democrat, not a Republican, about whether some of this was going on, and he denied it. Doesn't that undermine the public trust?
And you're conflating, first of all, me and Mr. Clapper.
And he's still on the job.
I understand. But what I'm saying is this, that yes, these are tough problems that I am glad to have the privilege of tackling. Your initial question was whether the statements that I made 6 months ago are ones that I don't stand by. And what I'm saying is that the statements I made then are entirely consistent with the statements that I make now, which is that we believed that we had scrubbed these programs and struck an appropriate balance, and there had not been evidence and there continues not to be evidence that the particular program had been abused in how it was used, and that it was a useful tool working with other tools that the intelligence community has to ensure that if we have a thread on a potential terrorist threat, that that can be followed effectively. What I've also said, though, is that in light of the disclosures that have taken place, it is clear that whatever benefits the configuration of this particular program may have may be outweighed by the concerns that people have on its potential abuse. And if that's the case, there may be another way of skinning the cat. So we just keep on going at this stuff and saying, can we do this better? Can we do this more effectively? I think that the panel's recommendations are consistent with that. So if you had a chance to read the overall recommendations, what they were very clear about is we need this intelligence. We can't unilaterally disarm. There are ways we can do it potentially that gives people greater assurance that there are checks and balances, that there's sufficient oversight, sufficient transparency. Programs like 215 could be redesigned in ways that give you the same information when you need it without creating these potentials for abuse. And that's exactly what we should be doing, is to evaluate all these things in a very clear, specific way. And moving forward on changes. And that's what I intend to do.
So you have no regrets.
That's what I intend to do. John Carl.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's been a tough year. You may not want to call it the worst year of your presidency, but it's clearly been a tough year. The polls have gone up and down, but they are at a low point right now. So what I'm asking you, you've acknowledged the difficulties with the healthcare rollout, but when you look back and you look at the decisions that you have made and what you did, what you didn't do, for you personally, what do you think has been your biggest mistake?
With respect to healthcare specifically, or just generally?
The whole thing. Back at this tough year.
There's no doubt that when it came to the healthcare rollout, even though I was meeting every other week or every 3 weeks. With folks and emphasizing how important it was that consumers had a good experience and easy experience in getting the information they need and knowing what the choices and options were for them to be able to get high-quality, affordable health care. The fact is it didn't happen in the first month, first 6 weeks, in a way that was at all acceptable. And since I'm in charge, obviously we screwed it up. Part of it, as I've said before, had to do with how IT procurement generally is done, and it almost predates this year. Part of it obviously has to do with the fact that there were not clear enough lines of authority in terms of who was in charge of the technology and cracking the whip on a whole bunch of contractors. So there are a whole bunch of things that we've been taking a look at, and I'm going to be making appropriate adjustments once we get through this year and we've gotten through the initial surge of people who've been signing up. But, you know, having said all that, bottom line also is that we've got several million people who are going to have health care that works. And it's not that I don't engage in a lot of self-reflection here. I promise you, I probably beat myself up, even worse than you or Ed Henry does on any given day. But I've also got to wake up in the morning and make sure that I do better the next day and that we keep moving forward. And when I look at the landscape for next year, what I say to myself is we're poised to do really good things. The economy is stronger than it has been in a very long time. Our next challenge, then, is to make sure that everybody benefits from that, not just a few folks. And there's still too many people who haven't seen a raise and are still feeling financially insecure. We can get immigration reform done. We've got a concept that has bipartisan support. Let's see if we can break through the politics on this. I think that hopefully folks have learned their lesson in terms of brinksmanship coming out of the government shutdown. You know, there have been times where I've thought about, were there other ways that I could have prevented those 3-4 weeks that hampered the economy and hurt individual families who were not getting a paycheck during that time? Absolutely. But I also think that in some ways, given the pattern that we have been going through with House Republicans for a while, we might have needed just a little bit of a bracing sort of recognition that this is not what the American people thinks acceptable. They want us to try to solve problems and be practical, even if we can't get everything done. So, you know, the end of the year is always a good time to reflect and see what can you do better next year. That's how I intend to approach it. I'm sure that I will have even better ideas after a couple of days of sleep and sun. Brianna.
Thank you, Mr. President. On the debt ceiling, your Treasury Secretary has estimated that the U.S. government will lose its ability to pay its bills come late February or early March. House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan has said that Republicans are going to decide what it is they can accomplish out of this debt limit fight, his words. Will you negotiate with House Republicans on the debt ceiling?
Oh, Brianna, you know the answer to this question. No, we're not going to negotiate for Congress to pay bills that it has accrued. Here's the good news. I want to emphasize the positive as we enter into this holiday season. I think Congressman Ryan and Senator Murray did a good job in trying to narrow the differences and actually pass a budget that I can sign. It's not everything that I would like, obviously. It buys back part of these across-the-board cuts, the so-called sequester, but not all of them. So we're still underfunding research. We're still underfunding education. We're still underfunding transportation and other initiatives that would create jobs right now. But, you know, it was an honest conversation. They operated in good faith. And given how far apart the parties have been on fiscal issues, they should take pride in what they did. And I actually called them after they struck the deal, and I said congratulations, and I hope that creates a good pattern for next year, where we work on at least the things we agreed to, even if we agree to disagree on some of the other big-ticket items. I think immigration potentially falls in that category, where here's an area where we've got bipartisan agreement. There are a few differences here and there, but the truth of the matter is that the Senate bill has the main components of comprehensive immigration reform that would boost our economy, give us an opportunity to attract more investment and high-skill workers who are doing great things in places like Silicon Valley and around the country. So let's go ahead and get that done. Now, I can't imagine that having seen this possible daylight breaking when it comes to cooperation in Congress, that folks are thinking actually about plunging us back into the kinds of brinksmanship and governance by crisis that has done us so much harm over the last couple of years. To repeat, the debt ceiling is raised simply to pay bills that we have already accrued. It is not something that is a negotiating tool. It's not leverage. It's the responsibility of Congress. It's part of doing their job. I expect them to do their job, although I'm happy to talk to them about any of the issues that they actually want to get done. So if Congressman Ryan's interested in tax reform, let's go. I've got some proposals on it. If he's interested in any issue out there, I'm willing to have a constructive conversation of the sort that we just had in resolving the budget issues. But I've got to assume folks aren't crazy enough to start that thing all over again.
If I may just quickly, on a more personal note, what is your New Year's resolution?
My New Year's resolution is to be nicer to the White House press corps. You know? Absolutely.
All right.
Major Garrett.
It's quite a lead-in, Mr. President. Thank you. Rick Leggett, who is the head of the NSA task force on Edward Snowden, told 60 Minutes that it was, quote, worth having a conversation about granting Edward Snowden amnesty. To what degree, sir, were you pleased that he floated this trial balloon, and under what circumstances would you consider either a plea agreement or amnesty for Edward Snowden? And what do you say to Americans, sir, who, after possibly being alerted to Judge Leon's decision earlier this week, reading the panel recommendations, believe Edward Snowden set in motion something that is proper and just in this country about the scope of surveillance and should not be considered by this government a criminal?
I've got to be careful here, Major, because Mr. Snowden is under indictment. He's been charged with crimes, and that's the province of the Attorney General and ultimately a judge and a jury. So I can't weigh in specifically on this case at this point. I'll try to see if I can get at the spirit of the question, even if I can't talk about the specifics. I've said before, and I believe that this is an important conversation that we needed to have. I've also said before that the way in which these disclosures happened have been damaging to the United States and damaging to our intelligence capabilities. And I think that there was a way for us to have this conversation without that damage. I'll give you just one specific example. The fact of the matter is that the United States, for all our warts, is a country that abides by rule of law, that cares deeply about privacy, that cares about civil liberties, that cares about our Constitution. And as a consequence of these disclosures, we've got countries who actually do the things that Mr. Snowden says he's worried about, very explicitly, engaging in surveillance of their own citizens, targeting political dissidents, targeting and suppressing the press, who somehow are able to sit on the sidelines and act as if it's the United States that has problems when it comes to surveillance and intelligence operations. And that's a pretty distorted view of what's going on out there. So I think that as important and as necessary as this debate has been, it is also important to keep in mind that this has done unnecessary damage to U.S. intelligence capabilities and U.S. diplomacy. But I will leave it up to the courts and the Attorney General to weigh in publicly on the specifics of Mr. Snowden's case.
But, sir, if I could follow up, Mr. Leggett is setting this in motion, at least raising this as a topic of conversation. You, sir, would, I'm certain, be consulted if there was ever going to be a conversation or a plea bargain with Edward Snowden.
I think that's true, Major, and I guess what I'm saying is there's...
You rule it out forever, that you would never consider it?
What I'm saying is that there's a difference between Mr. Leggett saying something and the President of the United States saying something.
I'm trying to get it either, sir.
That's exactly right. Chuck Todd.
Thank you, Mr. President. And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. You've talked about the issues with healthcare and the website rollout, but there have been other issues, the misinformation about people keeping their policies, the extended deadlines, some postponements. We have a new waiver that HHS announced last night. How do you expect Americans to have confidence and certainty in this law if you keep changing it? This one here, this new waiver last night, could argue you might as well have just delayed the mandate.
Well, no, that's not true, because what we're talking about is a very specific population that received cancellation notices from insurance companies. The majority of them are either keeping their old plan because the grandfather clause has been extended further, or they're finding a better deal in the marketplace with better insurance for cheaper costs. But there may still be a subset, a significantly smaller subset than some of the numbers that have been advertised, that are still looking for options, are still concerned about what they're going to be doing next year. And we just wanted to make sure that the hardship provision that was already existing in the law would also potentially apply to somebody who had problems during this transition period. So that's the specifics of this latest change. You're making a broader point that that I think is fair, and that is that in a big project like this, that what we are constantly doing is looking, is this working the way it's supposed to? And if there are adjustments that can be made to smooth out the transition, we should make them. But they don't go to the core of the law. First of all, the core of the law is that for 85% of the population, all they've been getting is free preventive care, better consumer protections, the ability to keep their kids on their insurance plan until they're 26, $1,000 or $500 discounts on prescription drugs for seniors on Medicare. So 85% of the population, whether they know it or not over the last 3 years, have benefited from a whole set of the provisions of the law. And by the way, if it were to be repealed, you would be taking away all those benefits from folks who already are enjoying them. You had this sub portion of the population, 15%, who either don't have health insurance or are buying it on the individual market. And that's still millions of people. And what we're doing is creating a marketplace where they can buy insurance and we can provide them some tax credits to help them afford it. The basic structure of that law is working, despite all the problems. Despite the website problems, despite the messaging problems, despite all that, it's working. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. We've got a couple million people who are going to have health insurance just in the first 3 months, despite the fact that probably the first month and a half was lost because of problems with the website and about as bad a bunch of publicity as you could imagine. And yet, you still got 2 million people who signed up, or more. And so what that means then is that the demand is there, and as I said before, the product is good. Now, in putting something like this together, there are going to be all kinds of problems that crop up, some of which may have been unanticipated, and what we've been trying to do is just respond to them in a common sense way. And we're going to continue to try to do that. But that doesn't negate the fact that, you know, a year from now or 2 years from now, when we look back, we're going to be able to say that even more people have health insurance who didn't have it before. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. That is part of the reason why I pushed so hard to get this law done in the first place. And, you know, I've said before, this is a messy process. And I think sometimes when I say that, people say, well, A, yeah, it's real messy. And B, you know, isn't the fact that it's been so messy some indication that there are more fundamental problems with the law? And I guess what I'd say to that, Chuck, is when you try to do something this big affecting this many people, it's going to be hard. And every instance, whether it's Social Security, Medicare, the prescription drug plan under President Bush, there hasn't been an instance where you tried to really have an impact on the American people's lives and well-being, particularly in the healthcare arena, where you don't end up having some of these challenges. The question is going to be, ultimately, do we make good decisions trying to help as many as people as possible in as efficient a way as possible. And I think that's what we're doing.
Well, with 72 hours to go, you make this change where people are buying the junk, frankly, a junk type policy that you were trying to get people away from.
Well, keep in mind, Chuck, first of all, that the majority of folks are going to have different options. This is essentially an additional net in case folks might have slipped through the cracks. We don't have precision on those numbers, but we expect it's going to be a relatively small number because these are folks who want insurance, and the vast majority of them have good options. And in a state like North Carolina, for example, the overwhelming majority of them have just kept their own plans, so the ones that they had previously. We thought and continue to think that it makes sense that as we are transitioning to a system in which insurance standards are higher, people don't have unpleasant surprises because they thought they had insurance until they hit a limit, and next thing you know, they still owe $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 for a hospital visit. That as we transition to higher standards, better insurance, that we also address folks who get caught in that transition and their unintended consequences. And I'll be honest, that was the original intent of the grandfather clause that was in the law. Obviously, the problem was it didn't catch enough people. And, you know, we learned from that, and we're trying not to repeat those mistakes.
The mandate to be enforced.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's see. Phil Mattingly.
Thank you, Mr. President. What was the message you were trying to send with not only your decision not to attend the Sochi Games, but also with the people you named to the delegation to represent the United States at those Games?
Well, first of all, I haven't attended Olympics in the past, and I suspect that, me attending Olympics, particularly at a time when we've got all the other stuff that people have been talking about, is going to be tough, although I would love to do it. I'll be going to a lot of Olympic Games post-presidency. I think the delegation speaks for itself. You got outstanding Americans, outstanding athletes, people who will represent us extraordinarily well. The fact that we've got folks like Billie Jean King or Brian Botano who themselves have been world-class athletes that everybody acknowledges for their excellence but also for their character, who also happen to be members of the LGBT community. You should take that for what it's worth, that when it comes to the Olympics and athletic performance, we don't make distinctions on the basis of sexual orientation. We judge people on how they perform, both on the court and off the court, on the field and off the field. And that's a value that I think is at the heart of not just America, but American sports. I'm going to just roll down these last few real quickly. Ari Shapiro. Last day of the White House, he deserves a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Senator Max Baucus was widely seen as the best hope for a large-scale deal to overhaul the tax code. What does your decision to nominate him as ambassador to China say about your hopes for a major tax bill in your second term?
It says that Max Baucus is going to be an outstanding ambassador to China, and I'd like a swift confirmation. And my expectation and hope is that if both the Senate Democrats, or if Democrats and Republicans in the House and the Senate are serious about tax reform, then it's not going to depend on one guy. It's going to depend on all of us working together. And my office is ready, willing, and eager to engage both parties in having a conversation about how we can simplify the tax code, make it fairer, make it work to create more jobs, and do right by middle-class Americans. Jackie Combs.
Thank you, Mr. President. And how do you say it in Hawaii? Mele Kaliki.
Mele Kaliki Maka.
Since we've been looking back at the year, I'd like to ask you what your reaction was to the nonpartisan truth-telling group, PolitiFact, when it said that the lie of the year was your statement that if you like your health care plan, you can keep it. And related to the health care problems that we've seen over the past year, the fallout from that seems to be making Democrats, particularly in the Senate, a little rambunctious and independent of you, which is evidenced most clearly in the debate over Iran sanctions. It looks like Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has expedited consideration of an Iran sanctions bill for January, even as your administration and you have been trying to get them to lay off sanctions while you're...
Jackie, I got to say, you're stringing a bunch of things along here. Let's see if we can hone in on a question. I mean,
That's a lot less than Ed Henry had.
How about I separate out the Iran question from the healthcare question? On the healthcare question, look, I think I've answered several times. This is a new iteration of it. But bottom line is that we are going to continue to work every single day to make sure that implementation healthcare law and the website and all elements of it, including the grandfather clause, work better every single day. And as I said in previous press conferences, we're going to make mistakes and we're going to have problems, but my intentions have been clear throughout, which is I just want to help as many people as possible feel secure and make sure that they don't go broke when they get sick. And we're going to just keep on doing that. On Iran, there is the possibility of a resolution to a problem that has been a challenge for American national security for over a decade now. And that is getting Iran to, in a verifiable fashion, not pursue a nuclear weapon. Already, even with the interim deal that we struck in Geneva, we have the first halt, and in some cases, some rollback of Iran's nuclear capabilities. The first time that we've seen that in almost a decade. And we now have a structure in which we can have a very serious conversation to see, is it possible for Iran to get right with the international community in a verifiable fashion to give us all confidence that any peaceful nuclear program that they have is not going to be weaponized in a way that threatens us or allies in the region, including Israel. And as I've said before, and I will repeat, it is very important for us to test whether that's possible. Not because it's guaranteed, but because the alternative is possibly us having to engage in some sort of conflict to resolve the problem with all kinds of unintended consequences. Now, I've been very clear from the start. I mean what I say. It is my goal to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, but I sure would rather do it diplomatically. I'm keeping all options on the table, but if I can do it diplomatically, that's how we should do it. And I would think that would be the preference of everybody up on Capitol Hill, because that sure is the preference of the American people. And we lose nothing during this negotiation period, precisely because there are verification provisions in place. We will have more insight into Iran's nuclear program over the next 6 months than we have previously. We'll know if they are violating the terms of the agreement. They're not allowed to accelerate their stockpile of enriched uranium. In fact, they have to reduce their stockpile of highly enriched uranium. Ironically, if we did not have this six-month period in which we're testing whether we can get a comprehensive solution to this problem, they'd be advancing even further on their nuclear program. And in light of all that, what I've said to members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, is there is no need for new sanctions legislation. Not yet. Now, if Iran comes back and says, we can't give you assurances that we're not going to weaponize, if they're not willing to address some of their capabilities that we know could end up resulting in them having breakout capacity. It's not going to be hard for us to turn the dials back, strengthen sanctions even further. I'll work with members of Congress to put even more pressure on Iran. But there's no reason to do it right now. And so I'm not surprised that there's been some talk from some members of Congress about new sanctions. I think the politics of trying to look tough on Iran are often good when you're running for office or if you're in office. But as President of the United States right now, who's been responsible over the last 4 years with the help of Congress in putting together a comprehensive sanctions regime that was specifically designed to put pressure on them and bring them to the table to negotiate, what I'm saying to them, what I've said to the international community, and what I've said to the American people is, let's test it. Now's the time to try to see if we can get this thing done. And I've heard some logic that says, well, Mr. President, we're supportive of the negotiations, but we think it's really useful to have this club hanging over Iran's head. Well, first of all, we still have the existing sanctions already in place that are resulting in Iran losing billions of dollars every month in lost oil sales. We already have banking and financial sanctions that are still being applied even as the negotiations are taking place. It's not as if we're letting up on that. So I've heard arguments, well, but you know, this way we can be assured and the Iranians will know that if negotiations fail, even new and harsher sanctions will be put into place. Listen, I don't think the Iranians have any doubt that Congress would be more than happy to pass more sanctions legislation. We can do that in a day, on a dime. But if we're serious about negotiations, we've got to create an atmosphere in which Iran is willing to move in ways that are uncomfortable for them and contrary to their ideology and rhetoric. And their instincts and their suspicions of us, and we don't help get them to a position where we can actually resolve this by engaging in this kind of action. All right? Okay, everybody. I think I'm going to take one more question. Colleen McCain Nelson, and that is it.
Thank you, Mr. President.
There you are.
Some of your longtime advisors are leaving the White House. Some new folks are coming in. Others are taking on new roles in the West Wing. As you reshape your team a bit, how does that change the dynamic here, and how does it impact what you think you can accomplish going forward?
You know, I just had lunch with Pete Rouse, who's leaving me, and that's tough.
He says so.
He says so, not right now, at least. I love that guy, and that will be a significant loss, although he'll still be in town, and hopefully I'll be able to consult with him on an ongoing basis. I think the fact that John Podesta is coming in will be terrific. He may deny it, but I've been trying to get him in here for quite some time. He ran my transition office. I asked him when he was running the transition office if he would be willing to join us, and at that time I think he was still feeling that he wanted to develop CAP and other organizations. But you know, John's a great strategist. He is as good as anybody on domestic policy, and I think he'll be a huge boost to us and give us more bandwidth to deal with more issues. I suspect that we may have additional announcements in the new year. There's a natural turnover that takes place. People get tired. People get worn out. Sometimes you need fresh legs. But what I can tell you is that the team I have now is tireless and shares my values and believes the thing that I think I've repeated probably four or five times in this press conference, which is we get this incredible privilege for a pretty short period of time to do as much as we can for as many people as we can to help them live better lives. And That's what drives them. That's the sacrifice they make, being away from families and soccer games and birthdays. And some of them will end up working over Christmas on issues like Iran. And the fact that they make those kinds of sacrifices, I'm always grateful for. And if they then say to me after making those sacrifices for 3, 4, 5 years, you know, I need a break, then I completely understand. All right? Have a great holiday, everybody. Appreciate you.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
That was President Obama wrapping up a wide-ranging end-of-year news conference at the White House. It lasted about an hour.
And an hour and 1 minute and 54 seconds.
Who's counting?
To be exact.
This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young here in Boston. We've got Scott Horsley, NPR's White House correspondent, as well as Julie Rovner, the NPR health policy correspondent, and NPR's national correspondent, national security correspondent, Larry Abramson in Washington. And Scott, I want to go to you first. The one thing that I could say about every question that was asked was President Obama was on the defensive, and this on a day when, by the way, the stock market is going to close at the highest level ever. The unemployment rate is at the lowest level of his presidency. Did it surprise you that he was on the defensive throughout that news conference?
No, not really. I mean, he came out and talked at the beginning of the news conference about some of the economic positives that we've seen. But a lot of those aren't really things that he can take a lot of credit for. It's, for example, the progress we've made in domestic energy production, domestic oil production in particular, domestic renewable energy. He can certainly take credit for through the stimulus, but the domestic oil production is, happened sort of in spite of, or at least independent of this president. No, I he was on the defensive because people were talking about things that are under his control, whether it's the intelligence gathering or the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, a lot of the questions weren't just about the mistakes and the mishaps along the way, but sort of a step above that, a more of a 30,000-foot level question of can the American people trust you, or how do you regain the trust of the American people? Because the polls are pretty clear that he has lost a lot of that trust. And so that's really where he had to be on the defensive.
Well, Scott, the toughest one had to be from Fox's Ed Henry, who said, you know, Americans seem to have lost confidence in you, trust in you. He said back when you were asked about the NSA when it was first revealed the leaks first occurred 6 months ago, you said that you felt that they'd scrubbed the program and struck the right balance. But Ed Henry said, no, even your own panel said you hadn't. And then he said, is it just like when you said people can keep their health plans and they can't? So pretty pointed question there.
Yeah, that was a tough question. But, you know, Julie Pace of the Associated Press right out of the gate was very tough and pointed as well. Mm-hmm. And Jackie Combs of the New York Times, who we heard from at the end, who was talking about the political fallout. Even Democrats on the Hill don't want to fall in line behind this president. And they're more likely to go rogue or put some daylight between themselves and this president because his own poll numbers have tumbled. And you know, he was pretty forthright in saying, look, my poll numbers have gone up and down. If I'd wanted high poll numbers, I would have stayed in the U.S. Senate where I had 70% approval rating. But there's no question that has all taken a toll this year. But as I expected, he sort of said, let's close the book on 2013, let's acknowledge our mistakes. And then he said, you know, 2014 needs to be a year of action. And he went right back to pitching the things that he wants Congress to do in the new year. One of the first items of business will be he'll be pushing, and there is some bipartisan push for this, to renew those extended unemployment benefits, which are due to run out in just about a week from now.
And weren't part of the budget deal. You mentioned Julie Pace. She's the one who very nicely said, has this been the worst year of your presidency? And he said, well, I don't think of it that way. But we just want to ask you, Scott, we move on and get some of our other experts here. But did you think he looked exhausted?
No, that is to say, no more than usual. Mm-hmm. Clearly, this has been a wearying year for the president and for the White House. And he did talk at the end there about, you know, some of the new burst of energy that they hope to get with the arrival of John Podesta, who did a lot of good for Bill Clinton in the latter years of his administration, and they are certainly hoping. Both from Podesta and just from the change in the calendar and from the website working better now, that there will be some burst of energy. And one bit of news that we did get actually from the top from the president, you know, we've been getting enrollment numbers from the government on a sort of delayed basis. In the middle of November, we hear about October's enrollments, and in the middle of December, we hear about November's numbers. Today, we heard in virtually real time that 500,000 people have signed up on the federal government's insurance website in the first 3 weeks of December. Now, that's still shy of the government's original forecast, but it does suggest a pretty strong acceleration in enrollments.
Yeah. Julie Ravner, he also said, since I'm in charge, obviously we screwed up talking about healthcare.gov. What did you take away?
That's right. And, you know, that he sort of volunteered that. Another of his, you know, questions looking back on the year, what do you regret most? What was your biggest mistake? And he kind of volunteered that it was the rollout of the health care law. But, you know, then he went on to say, you know, the bottom line is that several million more people are going to have health care. You know, what the administration sent out, in addition to what the president said, they actually sent out some numbers pointing out that more than a million people have signed up for private health plans on both the federal and the state exchanges since they opened, and that nearly 4 million people have been found eligible for Medicaid and CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. So a significant number of people are going to gain health insurance. And obviously, there's been this pushback about the people whose plans have been canceled. I think the administration wants to be out there making sure that the Republicans aren't going to be able to say that more people have lost their health plans than have gained them through the exchanges.
Well, Larry Abramson, I want to move to you, NPR national security correspondent. Now, during the press conference, Chris Saliza from The Washington Post tweeted out, everyone could have lived without this presser. But I'm wondering if you feel the same way, because he was asked many questions about the recent report on NSA surveillance. Right. What'd you hear?
Well, he was very cautious about not tipping his hand in one direction or another, because, as he said, he has a lot more work to do, I guess, during his vacation. It doesn't sound very relaxing to me that he's going to wait until January before he actually makes any decisions about the recommendations that the tech review panel just announced. But he did say that if there's a way for this bulk collection program to operate without having the government maintain the database of phone calls, maybe we should look into that.
Yeah, he said now, if the private phone companies can keep some of the records, yeah.
That's what the panel suggested, or a private entity could also do that. Now, it's a long way from saying that and actually implementing it. It would take a lot of software that the NSA says doesn't really exist right now. And also the NSA would have to make a big concession, because they've indicated that it's very important for them to be able to get this information immediately when they want to do these searches. But it did indicate that the president is thinking about some serious reforms of this program. He also said the same thing when it comes to protections for non-U.S. persons, people overseas. The panel was very critical of the fact that people overseas don't enjoy anything close to the protections that U.S. citizens or U.S. persons enjoy. Basically, they have almost no protections at all when it comes to NSA spying, and suggested that there should be more protections extended. And the president seemed to, again, give a nod in that direction, but he was, again, cautious that he didn't want to make any commitments here before he's had a chance to talk to everybody. And we really haven't heard what the NSA and the intelligence community themselves think about these proposals.
And Larry, we've just got a few seconds left, but he did not say whether he would think about granting any kind of amnesty to Edward Snowden, which was, of course, brought up in the 60 Minutes piece by an official there.
Right. Yes. And he was very cautious. And he said it's one thing for that official, Rich Ledgett, from the NSA to say those things. And it's something else when I, the president of the United States, say it. So it's like it's my decision, not his.
That's Larry Abramson, a terrific NPR national security correspondent. Larry, thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Robner's been with us, NPR's health policy correspondent. Julie, always great to talk with you.
Nice to be here.
And Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent. Scott, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
And this, as we have listened for over an hour to President Obama give his last presidential press conference of the year, touching on a range of issues. Of course, we'll continue to dissect them on your public radio station over the course of the day. Thank you so much for listening.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young.
This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston.